Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You are now listening to This Week Explained.
Hello, and welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana with Carvin as my co-host, and together we'll help you understand the complexities of our dynamic, ever-changing world. Let's get right into it, babe. What's on the agenda this week?
All right, we got Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas, as always. We will discuss Putin's landslide presidential win in a fair and democratic Russian presidential election.
Right.
That was sarcasm.
I feel like they just pulled like stock Russian photos of people to be his opponents.
Oh yeah,
because are they real? Anything about? Well, no, I know they're not actually stock photos. They are actual people that were, you know, pit against him in an obvious unfair fight. But
yeah,
okay,
obviously,
never mind. We'll get to that. We'll get to that a little later.
Right, then we'll get into new information out of Niger. Niger has removed U.S. military support from that country. And we've talked about this for quite a while on this podcast about how that's starting to be the shift in the Western Sahel. We'll get into North Korea. North Korea resumed their missile testing after a couple of months of not doing that. And then I finally want to get into some kind of breaking news that we had over the week from Reuters that SpaceX, the Elon Musk company, is building spy satellites for the United States.
Well, let's get right into it. What is the latest coming out of Ukraine?
So there's not much really going on as far as ground offensives. We're recording on Thursday, but early this morning, Russia did send some missiles into Kyiv for the first time in, I think, 3 or 4 months. So they are picking up their air offensive within Ukraine. But the stalling of the ground offensive is most likely due to the Russian elections that finished up over the last week, which we'll get into. There has been some increased aid from the U.S. that was sent to Ukraine recently. Now, there's also U.S. Republicans who have been kind of stopping or blocking aid to Ukraine or talking about that. They are floating an idea of a no-interest guaranteed loan to Zelensky and to Ukraine as a solution to continue support for that country during the Russian occupation.
Okay, well, what about sending NATO troops to Ukraine? I mean, I know there have been some reports about the pros and cons of that idea. So has there been any movement on that front?
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, France has been in the headlines recently because of some comments that were attributed to French President Macron about sending French troops into Ukraine to fight Russia. He denies it, and he continues to do that. That it's going to happen there. But he does, after denying it, he expresses his support for Ukraine. He states that France is not going to let Russia win this war. Now, Putin obviously jumped on this, and he publicly told the people of Russia that NATO, honestly, already has troops in Ukraine and that the Russian state is going to have to defend itself against this expanding NATO.
Gotta love the fear-mongering tactic that he is employing here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously NATO's not out to get like the civilian population, but that seems to be what he's trying to imply here. But is there any truth to Putin's claim that NATO forces are in Ukraine, or is he, like I said, fear-mongering?
Yeah, and Putin has a knack for choosing his words carefully. So this time he points out that NATO forces are already present in Ukraine. Now, while he does that, the Russian state media gets to emphasize their involvement, the NATO involvement in combat. In this case, Putin is technically correct because NATO forces are in Ukraine in this advise and support, or advise what the U.S. calls advise and assist, role. Now, if we had NATO forces actively fighting against Russia, that would undoubtedly be a major development, and you would see widespread external reporting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. He has to keep his people engaged in this war because obviously support is waning all over.
Yeah.
So let's shift focus to the Israel-Hamas war. What is the latest going on there?
Well, we got ceasefire negotiations, which are still ongoing. Hamas has presented its ceasefire deal, and then the mediators, along with Israel, are reviewing that. They're hoping to get that signed off in order to pause this conflict in hopes that humanitarian aid can then be brought in. Israel continues to plan its ground offensive in Rafah. They came out just hours before we started recording, and they said they don't care what the U.S. says or does.
Right.
They are going to do the offensive.
I saw that.
Yeah, and they've kind of already begun because they launched an air attack on the region. They claim that they targeted Hamas leadership that is in Rafah at this moment. And then another huge development, there was a raid at the Al-Shifa hospital. We've talked about that hospital a lot. And the IDF says it killed 90 Hamas gunmen and arrested 160 others in that raid.
I thought Hamas leadership weren't in Gaza.
Yeah, so it depends on who we're talking about. So senior leadership, you know, the tip of the spear, the top Hamas, they are in Doha. They're in places in Europe. They're hiding out in other areas. But the lower leadership, so the lower rungs below that, think of it like their generals and stuff are gone, but their commanders are all, you know, placed all over Gaza, and that's who's kind of coordinating the ground efforts for Hamas.
So how close are we to a ceasefire?
Well, you know, the fact remains, as the two sides do get close to an agreement, each time they get close, one side changes their demands, and then the talks fall apart.
That seems like it's on purpose.
Right, yeah. You know, the it's sort of like you're doing a contract negotiation, and you say, no, I'll take this much money.
And then you get the money, and then they're like, no, actually. Yeah.
They meet your demands, and then you go, and you see this a lot in the NFL. They'll go, this is how much my client wants. They'll broadcast that out to the public, and they use that as leverage because they actually wanted to go to another team, and they'll say, well, you see, this team is going to pay me $15 million a year or over 5 years. If you pay me $17, I'll come to you. They're using these negotiations as leverage for their own personal gain. And honestly, I'm going to say that the onus here is on the mediators,
because
they need to get both sides to the negotiating table in good faith. They need to first hash out a temporary ceasefire. Then they have to start discussing a permanent solution. The problem is, once a ceasefire is agreed to, all parties seem to want to pat each other on the back, do some public PR, and then go about doing other business. And then you get to the last minute when they need to extend the ceasefire. They come back and they go, well, let's do another ceasefire. Let's do another temporary Band-Aid to this. And we see it all the time in government. You know, I mean, look at, if you're in the U.S., you see it in the budget debate. It's like, hey, we need a continuing resolution for 3 months, and they do that, and then three months later,
kicking the can down the road.
Yep, they keep kicking the can down the road.
And increasing our national debt, but it's fine. They're working together, Kervin.
I know. And by the last minute, they'll come in and they'll go, oh, we need to vote on the resolution, and then they start blaming each other, and it's like, you're both to blame. But
yeah, well, with no clear peace agreement in sight, I guess we should discuss the official results of the Russian elections, where Putin won, you guys.
Yeah, surprise.
So surprised. This is my surprise face. You guys can't see it, but.
Oh, she looks very surprised for those that can't see, which is everybody.
Very surprised. It's actually, well, never mind. I was going to make an inside joke reference, but no one would get it but us. So.
Yeah, we won't do that.
Yeah, so anyways. Putin won in what the Russian state media is calling an historic landslide with the highest turnout in modern Russian history. Yeah. So, Kervin, I mean, I've already kind of made my opinion known at the start of the show, but what is this to be believed, or is the Putin regime fudging the numbers slightly?
Yeah, I think it was the biggest turnout since Stalin. And if you remember Stalin, that wasn't, you know, democracy at play.
No.
That was there. Now, the numbers are real from what I have seen. I'm not in Russia. I'm not getting true, you know, what could be considered factual data, maybe. But so far, yeah, that's very true. Now, whether the vast pro-Putin sentiment is true, that's a totally different conversation. But as you said, Putin won the election in what is, I mean, I would say it was legitimately a landslide, talking to 84%.
Yeah, and you talked about it last week when you said anything below 70% would have been, even though he would have won the election,
right,
he would have personally considered it a defeat if it was less than 70%. And then what happens? He got 84, was it between, I think, 84 and 87 something? I don't know. I've seen a bunch of different numbers, like between 83 and 87%.
And we're still counting. We're still counting. It was such a great, outpouring of voting.
Right.
That
they really wanted to
keep.
We're
still counting the numbers.
Yeah, still counting them. There's like numbers from all over the place.
Now, with that, I do want to say that there was some reporting. I saw some videos, some pictures that were posted, that voters were met with armed military and armed police at the ballot boxes. And that was especially true in those recently annexed regions.
So, just
take that with, you know,
take that with what? I mean, just... you're going to say a grain of salt, but I know, yeah, I know that's not what you meant. That's not what you were trying to say. Because that sounds super suspicious. And then, like I said earlier, they had several other people on the ballot, supposedly. And they all had extremely dismal numbers. But you haven't heard any, like, if you look in the news, you don't really see anything about these supposed, like, his supposed competition. You don't see anything about that, about those three people.
And none of those came out against Putin. They were just, they're basically figureheads for different parties, and they all supported Putin in his election campaign.
They all were like, this is fine. Why even run then?
You can vote for me, but you should really vote for Vladimir Putin.
I guess it was to bolster his claims that it's a fair election. Because if it was just him, obviously, people would be crying foul all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
So,
uncontested.
The fact that these people were in the election and they were like, you could vote for us, but we are Putin guys. We want Putin to stay in power for another 6 years. Like, that's proof right there. You know, why would they even run if they were voting for Putin themselves, which, you know, they voted for Putin.
They were forced to, most likely.
Yeah, they had the armed military and the police. So, yeah. Okay. Well, anyways. It seems that, not seems, it's pretty obvious that Putin's grip on power remains firm in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But what does this mean for the future of Russia's political landscape? Obviously it's not going to shift too much since it's him still, but...
Right. And like you said, and there was this lack of credible opposition candidates. There's also suppression of dissent. This all is signaling a narrowing of political space in Russia. What this could do is it could lead to increased internal tensions and potential instability in the long run. This is something we see in a lot in history, right? Somebody gets into power and they take too much power, and then the people revolt and the pendulum swings the other way. This also raises questions about the succession planning post-Putin, because Putin's not going to live forever. So what is that succession within something like this? It's not like, it's not like a monarchy where a family just keeps going.
He's working on that.
Yeah, he's working.
I mean, all he has is daughters, though, right?
Right, but...
That's all he has. And they're all private. They're notoriously private.
That's the big issue there. I don't think it's an issue that they're his daughters. I think it's an issue that they want to stay private. And he doesn't want to put them, unlike Kim Jong-un, which is definitely that regime is family-based, right?
Right.
So you're going to keep seeing the family move on. That's where we have a little bit, it's a little bit tough to predict what the future is going to look like. And with the absence of a clear successor, that adds uncertainty to Russia's future leadership.
Well, that obviously, it all makes sense. But now we need to turn to the international response to this election, this fair election that...
Free and fair. Week. I think that's...
The free and fair election that occurred with multiple oppositional candidates. I don't know what you're talking about. There were multiple. Yeah. So many Western countries have obviously criticized the election as undemocratic.
Mm-hmm.
Shocker. So how might this impact Russia's relations with the West? I mean, we don't really have much relations with Russia.
Not anymore. Because there was, you know, there was a time. The Obama administration had a decent relationship with Russia. I will say they were played by the Russians. That was with the Secretary of State that I won't name. You can go back and look in history of who the Secretary of State was. Then.
Why don't you want to name the Secretary of State? Is there something I'm missing
here? I can. It was Hillary Clinton, and I consider her the worst Secretary of State that career, the worst Secretary of State that was involved.
Well, all right.
So I have my own issues with her for other things.
I can't go down the Clinton route.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, once you get to that level of power, their corruption definitely sinks, goes in there. Like, usually people start the ground, when they hit the ground running, obviously things are from a more, like, civilian perspective. Like, they're more about the people and their constituents. But as their power increases, that it becomes more about greed.
But back to your question about how it's going to impact relations with the West, it's going to only further strain those already tense relations between Russia, the U.S., the U.K., all of the West. It reinforces the narrative of Russia as an authoritarian regime, which leads to potential diplomatic repercussions, increased sanctions, which do so much.
Boo!
Yeah.
We could have come up with something else.
Right. So all of that, even though the sanctions don't work, they still exacerbate geopolitical tensions. They hinder cooperation amongst even, you know, fairly allied, you know, countries, things like that.
I have no idea what you were trying to say right there.
Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to wrap my
head. Are you spacing out a little bit?
It's been a tough week.
It's been a tough week,
but it's just been long.
Tough. Well, we'll get to that later. If you decide to stick around, our dear listeners, we'll talk about our personal stuff.
Oh, we can only give a little bit of it, but I do want to get an update from last week.
Yeah.
But just what I was going to say, that on all these key global issues, it kind of hinders cooperation amongst, because even if you have an adversary, you do want to have that cooperation so it doesn't become an adversarial conflict.
Yeah. You want to have some sort of line of communication open with them. Because once they start isolating and they don't, like, but they don't communicate with you, like, who knows what's going on? At least if there is open dialogue, you can kind of suss out what's going on. You know, it goes both ways, honestly.
Right. You are exactly right.
So it's clear that Putin's victory will have far-reaching implications. But what about the internal dissent that we've seen in Russia, particularly in the form of the protests and the acts of defiance and, you know, people who attended Navalny's funeral? That probably didn't go... Yeah.
And there were some videos going around. There was one that kind of went viral of... I think it was outside of Russia. It was a voting outside of Russia. I'd have to fact check myself on that one, but it was a female that kind of poured ink into the voting box to destroy all of the ballots that were put in there.
And did it show what happened to her? Did the cops pull her away?
Actually, I think it was outside of Russia because she did just leave after that, and nothing happened to her.
Well, I hope she remains safe, because you know Russia will send out people to find her.
Definitely. So we hope she's safe.
Yes, we hope she's safe.
Despite Russia's efforts to suppress dissent, protests and acts of defiance continued to emerge. That kind of showed this underlying discontent among the population, even if it was a small population. Now, this dissent, although challenging to Putin, highlights the resilience of civil society in Russia. There are people who will stand up.
We do love Russia.
Yeah.
And the people we met in Russia were wonderful.
Yep.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. We got them to warm up to us.
Yeah.
At first, they were kind of standoffish, which I understand, because they had actually told us some stories about other American tourists that they'd worked with. And man, you guys need to get your crap together. You are making us look bad.
Some of you guys, yeah.
Going
in and trying to be this
macho alpha male BS.
Yeah.
Acting like you're so you're so great. You came into a country with a visa, which is required because you aren't a threat to them.
Right.
They don't care about you banging on your chest. Okay, sorry.
They let you in. But what I wanted to say was that even though this dissent seems like a small percentage of the population, there is potential for change in the future. So if enough voices rise up, we could see some changes in sentiment within the Russian state. And that, I think, is especially true the longer this war in Ukraine drags on.
Absolutely. So for now, looking ahead, what do you foresee as the key challenges and opportunities for Russia and its role on the global stage?
Yeah, Russia faces numerous challenges: economic stagnation, demographic decline, geopolitical isolation, but...
Demographic decline.
Yeah, well, so...
I was just thinking about another inside joke. I'm sorry, why do we have so many inside jokes?
But all this also possesses significant resources and influence for Russia, particularly in areas such as energy and regional security. So Russia has a lot of energy exports. They're a very large country. They are one of the multiple superpowers that are in the world. So they hold that regional security and then the energy. Now, moving forward, navigating these challenges while capitalizing on its strength is going to be crucial for Russia to maintain its position as a major player in global affairs. And this is why Putin is making a push to align with leaders from Iran and North Korea, while also trying to strengthen its relationship with the economic powerhouse that is China.
So while Putin revels in his victory, let's shift our focus to the African continent and the recent developments in Niger, which is a country that you have been to
yes,
a few times, particularly regarding the expulsion of U.S. troops from the country. So I guess that means the company that you worked for is not there anymore, not present. Okay, so you were actually on this U.S.-led counterinsurgency program in Niger.
Mm-hmm.
Several times. How many times did you have to go on rotation there? It was several times.
About 5 or 6 times, yeah.
Yeah, so could you shed some light on what led to this decision? Aside from us, they didn't want us to meddle anymore. I know it's not just that. It's not that black and white at all. Obviously, they're being influenced by
other countries.
Oh, sorry, I'm answering my own question, but now I need you to answer it because you actually have been there. I have never been there. And the only things I know about the country are the things that you told me. And I know you enjoyed yourself there.
Yeah.
Every time you went, you had your own little spots that you guys would go to and have dinner and
and great times.
You carved out a nice life. Yeah, made friends with people there. Mm-hmm. But obviously, tell us about it.
So this decision to expel U.S. troops from Niger, it stems from quite a few factors. You kind of alluded to one of those. There have been concerns raised by the ruling military junta, the new military government that's there, about Niger's relationship with both Russia and Iran. Now, U.S. officials have expressed unease over Niger potentially allowing Tehran access to its uranium reserves to build up its nuclear program. That definitely strained relations, not to mention the same Russian disinformation campaign that ousted France from the continent. And I think that's honestly what you were alluding to right there.
Right.
Is ramping up now. It got France out, and now it's ramping up against the U.S.
Well, I mean, the next step.
Yeah, we predicted that was going to happen months ago.
So would you say that these concerns are the primary driver behind the expulsion of U.S. troops?
Yeah, they certainly play a significant role. But we have to
whenever I say these concerns, do you mean like us being vocal about our concerns about Tehran having access? That is what is behind it, not...
Yes.
Okay, there.
Yeah, definitely.
I need to clarify. I kind of misspoke a little bit. I needed to clarify so that people understood what I was saying. It's the voicing our concerns
publicly.
Publicly. That's what's kind of helping get us. We're being pushed out, edged out a little bit.
Yeah, it's playing a significant role in that. But I do want to note the broader political landscape in Niger. So the military junta took over following the ousting of what we publicly say was a democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum. That was last July. That's whenever they ousted the president. This change in leadership shifted the country's geopolitical alignments. So, like I said, we kind of predicted this back in August, that Russia was going to start their disinformation campaign against the U.S. as a as a colonizer, and they need to get out.
Colonize.
Right. As they push west to colonize former Russian.
Under the guise of them being helpful, they're offering help and money, supposedly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now we're seeing Niger align themselves more with Russia.
Well, you were beating that drum as soon as the junta took over.
Yep.
So now what implications does this expulsion have for the U.S. interests in that region? Because make no mistake, we also were getting something out of being there.
We were getting a ton of things. It's a substantial setback for U.S. counterterrorism efforts in the Western Sahel. Niger has been a critical base for U.S. operations, particularly mm-hmm. that airbase 201 in Agadez.
Is that where you were?
Oh, no, I didn't go to that one. I was one of the ones pushing back against it because I didn't want to go to Agadez because it's basically the middle of nowhere and in the desert, and they just put a military base there.
Like out in the open?
Yeah.
So there's nothing to protect you?
But no, I mean, there's stuff to protect me, but there's nothing to do. You're just
sitting
in a tent all day.
Was Niger where they had the knockoff, what's it called? Hard Rock Cafe?
No, that was Chad.
Oh, man.
It's
okay.
The same area.
Yeah,
that was in N'Djamena. That was awesome.
I'm still bummed that we didn't get those knockoff Chad Hard Rock Cafe t-shirts.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
That would have been so great. But anyways, sorry.
Now, losing access to that base severely limits the U.S.'s ability to conduct surveillance and then gather intelligence on the militant groups that are operating in the area. Those are al-Qaeda. We call it al-Qaeda in the Western Sahel. And then the Islamic State has affiliates there as well. And that's going to further destabilize the region.
Well, it sounds like a significant blow indeed. Moving forward, is there any hope for salvaging the U.S.'s presence in Niger? Or do you think it's just too far gone?
Well, I think so. The Pentagon is saying publicly that it is actively working through diplomatic channels to seek clarification. They want to find a way forward. But given the current political climate and then the military junta's stance against the U.S., it remains uncertain. I think highly unlikely that an agreement can be reached. The U.S. is closely monitoring the situation. They're going to have to pay particular attention to getting everything out of that military base, unlike what they did in Afghanistan.
Where they just bailed on the million-dollar equipment.
And so the U.S. is closely monitoring the situation. They're exploring alternative options in those neighboring countries we still have troops in.
Then, as that gets sorted out, let's pivot to the Indo-Pacific. most notably the Korean Peninsula. North Korea recently fired multiple short-range ballistic missiles towards its eastern waters. I mean, I'm going to ask this question, but obviously I already know what prompted this sudden escalation.
Yeah, so it, you know, the timing, you could probably tell that with
Was it last week? Within the last couple weeks, at least, South Korea and the United States had those drills.
There you go. So,
and they don't like
it. Answering your question.
Right.
Again, so this happened shortly after the conclusion of those military drills between South Korea and the United States. Now, North Korea long viewed these drills as a rehearsal for invasion of its country. And so their response is with missile tests. And so this is not uncommon.
Interesting. So how significant are these missile tests in terms of North Korea's military capabilities?
Well, as we always say when discussing North Korea, the tests serve as a reminder of North Korea's military prowess. They want to keep letting people know we have a military and we can use it.
No one's forgotten. We promise. We know you have a military.
Now, yeah, while they may not pose an immediate threat to the U.S., or at least the U.S. mainland, North Korea certainly can target South Korea and Japan, and that's where there is a significant U.S. military presence. Additionally, North Korea's pursuit of nuclear warheads on these missiles adds a layer of concern for regional stability.
And with Kim Jong-un at the helm, that is indeed worrying, but I'm glad it's not his sister either, because she's worse, in my opinion. She's a spicy meatball.
Yep.
So now, how have neighboring countries like Japan and South Korea responded to these provocations?
Well, both Japan and South Korea strongly condemned North Korea's actions. They emphasized the threat they pose to regional peace and security. Japan's prime minister denounced the missile tests, highlighting their violation of UN security resolutions. So meanwhile, South Korea's military heightened its surveillance posture, and it is closely coordinating with the United States and Japan in response to those North Korean provocations.
Well, it's clear that tensions are running very high in the region. So looking ahead, what implications do these missile tests have for the future diplomacy between the United States and North Korea?
Yeah, the missile tests are part of North Korea's broader strategy to enhance its leverage in future diplomacy. That's particularly with the United States. So by showcasing its military capabilities, North Korea wants to secure concessions, possibly seeking sanctions relief while maintaining its nuclear arsenal.
So they want their cake and to eat it too.
Right. Now, the U.S. and its allies publicly state they remain vigilant. They're not going to let North Korea take advantage of maybe lack security in the region, which reaffirms their commitment to regional defense and security in the Indo-Pacific.
Okay, well, thank you for those insights. Now let's get to the final topic of the episode. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So last week, Reuters reported that SpaceX, under a classified contract with the U.S. National Reconnaissance Office, or the NRO, is developing a vast network of spy satellites known as Starshield. So what are the... I don't know why I started laughing. It's called Starshield. I feel like I'm living in a sci-fi movie with the things that are popping up technologically. Just in the last 3 years, things have like exploded.
Yeah, science fiction can become science fact.
It's blowing my mind. So what are the key takeaways from this revelation?
It's funny to me that this has become an issue, but the development of Starshield does mark a significant advancement in U.S. space capabilities. So we've got hundreds of Earth imaging satellites in low Earth orbit. Now, this network promises enhanced intelligence gathering and military surveillance capabilities. And so that's what's raising concerns among global powers. That includes China, about potential threats to their own security.
Indeed. And speaking of China, their response to this news has been quite critical, which is funny because was it them and Russia? They were talking about space wars or whatever.
Yep.
Okay, yep. So, all right. Well, the People's Liberation Army accused the U.S. of hypocrisy and urged vigilance against perceived security threats. So how do you interpret China's reaction to the Starshield project? I mean, we're all hypocrites. All
right. Hypocrites calling out hypocrites. Right.
Right. Everybody is a hypocrite in this scenario for sure, because everyone just wants to be the first and the best and the most powerful.
Right. And then it's all packaged in this. Well, it's for national security.
Right.
Have to do
That's
this
how they have for... to frame. So they to get garner support, they have to kind of frame it that way. Otherwise, they'll be like, why are you spending our tax dollars on this BS?
Correct. Now, China's reaction just further shows the growing competition between the U.S. and China, especially in space and technology domains.
Right.
So the PLA's concerns about U.S. surveillance capabilities reflect broader anxieties about American hegemony and then American technological dominance. Additionally, China's plans to develop its own satellite constellations indicate its intent to counterbalance U.S. strategic initiatives in space.
Who's shocked that they also want to do something similar? I mean, we're all,
And North Korea's there doing
each other.
They want their little spy satellites up there, too.
And that's working out really well.
Yes.
I mean, eventually they will be able to accomplish what they're setting out to do. But
right, anyways. No doubt.
Now, Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, has been at the center of various controversies of late, including his control over Starlink, which is SpaceX's broadband project, which is being utilized throughout the Ukrainian conflict. Mm-hmm. So how might these controversies impact SpaceX's collaboration with U.S. intelligence agencies?
Well, I mean, that's the main reason this got so much attention, right? And I say that's why Reuters actually published this, because it was Elon Musk, and Reuters is more of a left-leaning journalist outfit. So they don't like Elon Musk. They wanted to give him a black eye for what he might be doing, or stop it before it actually does become a thing. But, and I say this because if it were one of the dozens of other defense contracting companies, or even like one of the current top technological companies like Meta or Google or something, this would have been a blip on the radar. They probably wouldn't have even tried to investigate this. But Elon Musk's involvement is in contentious geopolitical issues, such as the Ukraine conflict, has the potential to strain SpaceX relationships with government agencies, not to mention his outspoken nature on Twitter/X or on various podcasts. But despite his innovative contributions to space exploration, Musk's actions have at times raised concerns among policymakers, but it's essential to differentiate. I'm just going to blow through it. Sorry.
Yeah, you are trying to speed
up. It's essential to differentiate between SpaceX commercial ventures like Starlink and its classified contract, which it does have with the U.S. government.
Well, let's delve deeper into the broader geopolitical aspects of the Starshield project and the intensifying competition in space between the major powers, which I mentioned earlier about China being upset about our satellite possibilities or whatever. As they do the exact same thing.
Right. So the Starshield project reflects a broader trend of militarization and competition in space. We have Space Force. You know, they made a lot of fun of Trump for doing Space Force, and it is now we see why it wasn't him that did it. It was the Pentagon that said, hey, we kind of need to do this because Russia's advancing in space. China's advancing in space.
And he was just pumped to be the one to roll it out.
Oh, yeah.
To take credit for it.
Of course.
Yeah.
we have to identify that when we're talking about politics. Like, the president isn't creating these things.
No. There are thousands of other people that are working on this stuff behind the scenes.
There are institutions that are too big to fail that are working on these things. But space does have implications for global security and stability. So as space becomes increasingly contested, nations are prioritizing the development of space-based surveillance and reconnaissance capabilities. This highlights the need for multilateral cooperation, diplomatic efforts to prevent the weaponization of space. We talked about the nuclearization of space with Russia.
Space nukes.
Space nukes. I would love to mitigate the risk of conflict escalation. That's why I keep being outspoken about these things.
Well, absolutely. And now, turning our attention back to China's response to this, how do you think China's criticism of the Starshield project fits into its broader strategic objectives in the space domain?
Well, yeah, I mean, this criticism of the Starshield project aligns with its strategic objective of challenging U.S. dominance in space. If they can get it to stop, or they can get enough people to cry out against it, maybe they can then advance past what the U.S. is doing. So by portraying the U.S. as a threat to global security, China wants to bolster its own position as a responsible spacefaring nation, as they're destroying satellites and causing space debris. Also, China's warnings about the U.S. surveillance capabilities serve as a rally for support for its own space initiatives. It's the easiest way to get people to buy in, to spend money for things that they're not going to benefit from. You tell them you will benefit because you'll be safe and you'll still be alive. That includes the development of indigenous satellite constellations.
Indigenous satellite constellations.
You like that, huh?
Yeah, okay. So, all right, we have wrapped up the news portion of this. Do you have anything else for us? This is the personal part. If you are only here for the news, we suggest you click off now. Turn it off.
But we do have some exciting news. Well, first of all, we just got back from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
First of all, I really enjoy, I'd never been to Massachusetts before in my life. I don't think I've ever been that far north.
And you know, I don't think you have.
I don't think I have at all. So it was really, really cool to be there. The food we got to talk about the food real quick. Okay. First of all, the food was delicious. Everywhere we ate, everything was cooked perfectly. Okay. So I'm not trying to talk garbage about the cuisine that's up there because it was really good. But we are from the dirty South. We have to have hot sauce with our food. And Boston does not at all.
No, they have one hot sauce.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, first of all, we went into a Mexican restaurant. Okay. We were in a Mexican restaurant. We're eating our food, but it was not spicy, even though we wanted it to be spicy. Kervin asked for hot sauce. Our waiter disappeared for 10 minutes. And when he came back, he sheepishly handed him a bottle of Tabasco that had maybe 3 drops on the bottom. And he said, "This is the only hot sauce we have in the entire restaurant." It's a Mexican restaurant.
Now, in his defense, he was upset about that.
Probably because he was giving us a bottle that was basically empty, probably opened in 1972 by the looks of it.
It did look like
how crusty it was. And Tabasco is the worst hot sauce of them all.
Yeah.
It's like pepper vinegar, but not the good pepper vinegar that you get from Pennsylvania.
No, it's the bad stuff.
It's not very good. We are not fans of Tabasco.
And for us being from that area, I will say, I don't like Tabasco at all.
Yeah. We are not Tabasco people. But so, and then we went to a diner one of the days and we asked for hot sauce. And on the flip side of that, we got a brand new bottle of Tabasco that no one had touched because they just had it on hand for the freaks like us, I guess. I guess they just don't like spice or seasoning or something.
Which was excellent.
It was good.
You know, it was a great meal, but it was bland. It was still bland. We had to, salt and pepper, and
yeah,
I did use the Tabasco. We both used the Tabasco on it just to give it some more flavor.
Yeah, but like we said, everything was always cooked perfectly. Everything tasted really fresh. Everything was really good, except for the lack of seasoning and hot sauce.
Yeah.
And
as history buffs, it was just a great trip to walk around and see, you know, moments of history in our small, tiny little republic that we have here, called the United States.
Small, tiny little republic. But anyways, we really, really, really did enjoy our time there. And it was, I mean, obviously it was a work trip, but it was still nice to kind of get away for a little while, and the drive is not that bad. I did not realize we were actually that close to New York City. I thought we were farther away from that. I really did. I thought it was 8 hours away. But I mean, obviously, I guess it would be during like traffic.
Like, oh, yeah, definitely. From DC traffic to New York traffic.
Yeah. I mean, we did have to drive through the Bronx and go over the George Washington Bridge, which was horrible.
Yeah.
Both times. It was so, the traffic is insane. Like, the traffic starts in Connecticut and then it starts It starts piling up in New Jersey, leading into the Bronx, and it just doesn't let up the whole time. And you have to pay attention because there's so many exits.
Yeah.
That, I don't know. I don't like driving in cities at all. I have not looked at it. I told Kirvin that I am completely disinterested in honing my city driving skills. I'm fine with being the passenger princess. Fine with it.
And you were great. You were a great passenger princess.
No, there was a couple times, like I said, when we were in New York, when I was like, what are you doing? Because you were doing some Batman maneuvers and I was getting a little motion sick.
As everyone does when they ride with me.
I mean, you have to drive defensively.
I did shave an hour off of
the time, so. That's impressive. With the amount of metro areas we had to drive through, the fact that you shaved an hour off, it was super impressive. And he didn't drive super fast either. Somehow he just was able to get around all the...
Yeah, there were a ton of cops out.
My throat. There weren't... Yeah, on the way up, there were a ton of cops. But on the way down, there were... You're making it sound like you drove so dangerous...
I didn't drive fast or anything like that. And I said, yeah, and there were a ton of cops. So I was being safe.
I didn't really see any cops on the way down.
They were there.
I mean, on the way back. Okay. Well, I guess I spaced out thoroughly the entire time. I disassociated because I did not want to be in the car for how long we were. Anyways.
But we made it.
We did.
So do you want to get in?
Well, hold on. You should talk more about the MIT stuff because I kind of cut you off and started talking about the hot sauce issue.
I mean, we were hosted. Well, I was hosted in by the PhDs over at MIT to
the brilliant minds.
Yeah, and certainly they are. I mean, I had to do a briefing for those guys, and then they briefed us on quite a few things, and you could tell who was smarter than everyone else.
Yeah.
It wasn't me. But just a bunch of the kind of technologies that are being worked on.
Which I guess you can't really get into too much.
Yeah, right? not that they're classified or anything, but just a bunch of fun stuff in like augmented reality, ISR. Systems, you know, that's a background that I have. So seeing the improvements in ISR systems was just fascinating for me. And I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot of great things. I learned a lot about the witch trials because we went up to Salem as well.
Well, yeah. I mean,
you knew about all of this stuff.
Well, no. Not, that's what I'm saying. I was just a little, just like I said, we went to the Salem Witch Museum and it was pretty expensive to get in there. But they hardly had anything in there at all for the amount we had to pay. The only thing they had from the actual time period was the original, what was it? It was like a header beam.
Yeah.
In the original.
For the door.
Yeah, for the Dale. The jail in Salem. That's the only thing they had. I thought they would have more things from the time period or
I wish they would have
creepy. Like I liked the opening of it because you can tell they used the old mannequins. They were really creepy looking mannequins.
Well, it was like you could tell it was started in the 70s and they haven't changed it.
I mean they're tried. But
another
just
I'd say another thing was that I was a little disappointed in, because we went to the oldest pub in Boston.
Yeah.
And yeah, the food was great. It was really good, but it was all modern American food.
So you wanted like pub food from the time period?
Well, I wish there was like an option for an older pub meal or an older, you know, a beer from that time.
Yeah.
Or an ale or something like that.
And like I said to you at the dinner, don't get yourself a Sam Adams.
Yeah, just get a Sam Adams.
Just get a Sam Adams. I know you wanted like a beer that was brewed, like the same recipe.
Yeah.
Like the beers that you can get from like bottle shops these days that were brewed by monks in the 15th century. It's the same recipe from the 15th century.
Or when we go to, you know, to George Washington's estate. And the restaurant that's on Mount Vernon has...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Now, it's not the same ale or beer, but they have the recipe, and they've recreated it from the recipe. And you can order that.
Yeah. So you wanted something like that. We wanted more history, I think.
Yeah, even if it's terrible, I would pay for it. Yep.
So, do you have anything else for us?
Nope, that's it for me, unless you wanted to add anything.
I don't have... anything nearly as cool to add. And plus, I just spent about 15 minutes complaining about Tabasco. So I think people are tired
of me. Not a sponsor.
Not a sponsor. And they're going to be like, we will never sponsor you.
Mm-hmm.
I like Louisiana hot sauce and Crystal, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to our tiny little geopolitical podcast. We hope you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please let us know. And if you would like in-depth coverage of these stories and more, follow us on Instagram at Open Analytics.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
This podcast is a production of Unfiltered Studios. If you would like to know more about joining Unfiltered Studios, please visit our website at unfpod.com for more information.